Hey, welcome back, everybody, to my podcast. It's the 50th episode with EuroLeague CEO Paulius Motiejūnas. And if you're new to this podcast, please subscribe. If you're not new to this podcast and you've been a listener for a while and you're not subscribed, you please also do so, because 70% of listeners that are listening to or watching it on YouTube are unsubscribed. So if we want to continue to bring great guests on this podcast, we need more subscribers. If you want to support this podcast, go to Patreon, support this podcast on Patreon, please. And we're going to continue to bring on guests. We don't stop. It's just going to keep growing. And we need you to be a part of it. With Paulius today, we talked about his time at Žalgiris, from the beginning of the changes he went through, the coaching changes that he made, what he looked for in coaches, how the building the culture in Žalgiris went about, the lessons he learned throughout this time. And then we transition into the EuroLeague, of the vision that he has for the EuroLeague, as well as what he sees the TV rights coming together and how he envisions the EuroLeague going forward. Please enjoy this episode. Again, please subscribe, share with friends, like, comment it, and I'll see you on the next episode. Bye. Paulius, what's up, man? Welcome to my podcast.
Welcome.
Welcome.
Great to be here. As I told you, I was listening. I'm a huge listener and a fan, and to be here, it's a privilege. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you for coming. It's your turn now. I'm a little bit out of shape. It's a 50th episode, 1 month now without any kind of recording. So excuse me if I'm missing some words. I'm a little bit behind on my brain functions right now.
Okay, I'll help you to get through it.
All right. We'll get through it together, holding hands.
Yeah.
So first of all, congrats on Executive of the Year. Once again, congrats on being promoted to CEO of the EuroLeague. Congrats on EuroLeague Final Four this year, being a host. Did I forget anything? Is there anything else I should congratulate you on?
No.
No, okay.
It's a fruitful year for our organization, for the organization of Žalgiris. I'm with two hats, you know, stepping down from one and diving to another one. So it's some of these congratulations are for Žalgiris. So it's a huge honor to us as organization. I always say, you know, I'm only taking the awards, but all the people who are doing the job behind the scenes, they are the ones who get the awards.
Yeah, I totally. There's a lot of jobs being done behind the scenes. That so many workers, so many people that are helping on all ends. And you know, sometimes with big organizations, you have loose ends and nobody sees them. Only the workers see them. A lot of times, the artists when they paint the picture, only they see the mistakes. You know, and it takes a big organization, a lot of people, a lot of small roles to keep everything in place. And I'm sure that there is a lot of helping hands around you, but also, at the same time, may all those awards rest in peace, because now you came to my podcast and we're going to talk about the problematics behind the scenes as well as what everybody may see. I divided it up in two halves. We go old school today. We're going to talk about Žalgiris a little bit, and the second half will be a little bit about the EuroLeague. And so we'll cover both bases. We're going to go a little bit. It's not going to be 20 minutes and 20 minutes like it used to be, but we're going to try to balance it out so it's a little bit, so everybody can digest the information well. But first of all, we go back to 2013, so it's actually our 10-year friendship anniversary. Congrats on that as well.
There you go.
What do you remember from that summer when we first met and worked with the national team?
I remember two of us going to the arena all the time in the morning. I think after practices, we came back after practices, everybody goes for lunch to take a nap. And we went back after lunch back to the arena. You had to do the scouting. I was the guy responsible to bring you coffee so you would have energy. and then we go through the game, and because we played as well, and then we go back. Great memories.
Yeah, you were my coffee guide that year.
Coffee and you know, checking on you if you're still locked in or not, because it's, you know, to spend full day and not one day but day after day for a week to be, you know, watch I don't know how many games we watched, and then be ready to the game that we play with the team. That's you know, for the guys who know basketball, it's a huge challenge, because I always keep saying, you know, you're staying in this arena, you don't know what time it is, you don't know what, you know, what's the weather outside, you don't know anything, you're kind of locked in, so there's no oxygen, and it's, I don't want to cry about it, but it's harsh conditions for sure.
Yeah, you were my partner in crime, I can say so for sure, because it was very, very, cruel, let's say. Yeah. But, you know, you do that together, and it's easier when you do it together, just like with your organization, you do it together with your, with your workers, with your partners. And going back to the time when you started at Žalgiris, what do you remember when you came in? It was a difficult situation for the organization. How did you envision when you came into the organization? What's the vision? What was the vision for Žalgiris at first? And when you look back, how much did it change over the years? Where do you think that were the biggest steps that you made?
I mean, there were two entries. One was I was in two crises. So the first crisis was when the new owners were supposed to come in. So I was supposed to come in only for 3 days because the board resigned, the director quit, and they were doing a due diligence. So the board asked me to come in for 3 days to finish the documents and everything. And it turned out that when they did the due diligence, they changed their mind and they said, we are not coming in. So, you know, I don't remember the exact date, but it was just the start of a season, like two or three months into the season. And we had no money, we had all the contracts, and nobody was coming to help. So, you know, we were on our own. I was fresh. I knew the players, which helped. I knew the coach. But again, the mentality of Žalgiris was there. So I was open to all the guys. I didn't know how to solve the issue. I had no idea how to solve the issue. So I said, guys, this is the situation, you know. We're in difficult spot. We don't have any money. If you want to leave, leave. If you have any offers, you know, tell your agents, go. We will have, you know, no problem with you leaving, you know, so that you can get paid. If you stay here, you know, we'll do whatever it takes to get as much money as possible to, you know, we'll pay up in a couple of years. And it was, you know, it was a survival mode on nonstop. Because there was a huge risk for us to go bankrupt, and then again, I told the players, if we go bankrupt, nobody gets anything. You don't get anything. Nobody gets anything. So, again, the Lithuanian mentality and the love for the team was there. So the players stayed, the coach stayed, some of the players left, and then the new owner came in who saved the club. We paid the, you know. The guys had to put their salaries down to get paid. And then, you know, a new era started. Strangely to me, I thought that after, you know, the new owner, he will say thank you, you know, and goodbye, and he will put another guy. But the organization said, okay, you know, you stay, help us out. And I stayed there for the time till I went and met you in the Federation days. And then after 2 years, the second crisis. So second crisis was, I don't want to say easier. We had more debt, but we had the arena. I already had some know-how of how to solve the issue. And I, you know, I thought I can do it. Again, the players were still there that I knew, and they had the trust in me. So I didn't understand the financial problems that we faced. Because it was different information, and you know, I had to do the due diligence later. But again, it took longer, but somehow we managed to survive, and everything else is history, like you said.
Yeah, everything else turned out to be, you know, just going. The curve just kept going upwards. I mean, it's always going to be. It's never going to be straight line, you know, exponentially. Yeah. So there's always going to be ups and downs in any kind of, you know, relationship, organization, whatever you call it. But usually I ask this question at the end, but I think it's very fitting in this scenario, because during this era that you went through, these crises and these situations, if you go back, and it's been a success story, but was there a favorite failure that you can look back on that you gained from the most during this era, that you learned from, and that some kind of mind shift went on for you that you kind of felt like, okay, this was the big lesson for me that I have to build on? You know, if you look back during these tough times that you had and maybe some good times that you had.
I think the biggest failure I had was that I was naive. You always think, you know, we always try to think how we would act in one another situation. And, you know, it's typical for, I don't want to sound Lithuanian, but it's quite typical for us to say, oh, you know, to judge the guy and say, oh, if I was in his situation, I would do this way. And I was naive and I came in and I thought that, you know, I give a speech, you know, we're in this together, let's stay together, let's fight, and, you know, let's somehow survive and be positive. But it didn't work this way. So I had to learn the hard way that, you know, some guys left, they took us to court. They didn't want to wait. Eventually, you know, especially the foreigners, they had the excuse they always use is, I have to take care of the family.
Yep.
So yeah, that was my biggest mistake, that I was naive and I took it personally. Every time, you know, when the guys left, because I if you play for Žalgiris, I like you. You're part of it, you know, you're part of the team and I will support you in any way. And I was kind of expecting to get back the same approach, but it doesn't go this way. So they all have families to take care of. They always have, you know, they made a choice. You made a promise and you have to stick with your promise. All these excuses, no matter who did it, it comes to the club. So you have to take the responsibility for it. So I would say, you know, I was too optimistic about the love for the team and for the game, because at the end, it's a cliche, but it's just business, you know, for the majority of the guys.
Yeah, I feel the same way when I entered this business at the higher level, at the highest level, quite honestly. You start seeing the other side of it, you know. You kind of takes your virginity in that sense, you know. As a player, as a young coach, up and coming coach, you have this emotions that are hard to replicate. They're not replicable. They're natural, right? And then at some point, you see, like you said, the naivety kind of goes away, and you see the fog just kind of disappears. You see the real picture a little bit. It kind of takes a piece of your heart away. You know, it's painful. Would you say that you became more, I don't want to say cold-blooded, but in terms of just towards the other contracts or towards the next players that came in, a little bit more harsher?
No. Okay. I want to bring, I mean, for me, this club was and still is something, you know, of a historical and emotional thing. And I always keep saying that we will stay this way. So if I find the guy who's only business, then okay, I put the, you know, for me, the typical phrase was that, okay, guys, I'm trying to help in the crisis. I know that, you know, it's a difficult situation, but if you help me, I will help you. As soon as you go to the court, or if you go to, you know, I start to talk to your lawyers, don't expect me, you know, to be the same kind of guy. As soon as you go to the lawyers, I'm on the defensive side. And I will do everything to save the club, no matter how much I like you, or, you know, because you chose the side and you want to play
this.
That's
the line.
So,
that's the line.
So these rules, you know, you have to play on the same rules. You cannot come to the boxing match, you know, and play with the basketball, you know. But it did not change the passion and the love. Like, it's still there. And these are my values. And these are the values of organization. So we have to stick with the values, and if we find that we have a person who doesn't share it, he, you know, we'll try to get rid of him in the team or in the organization as soon as possible. Because I think, you know, this is the key thing. Without that, you know, you have to be somebody different. And I'm not the kind of guy to say, okay, it's only business, you know.
So let's talk about values and the tradition, because there is a lot of tradition in the locker room. There is a certain norms that you have to follow, values that you have to hold yourself by. And I even owe the organization 10 push-ups because I stepped on the logo. So I learned it, but I haven't done the push-ups yet. I still have to do them. I'll put them with extra percentages on top. But I'm thinking, where does the tradition, everybody knows where the tradition comes from historically, but what values, what certain norms did you look for, how to cultivate the culture, how to build the culture from within the locker room, within, because a captain is very important, not only in a national team, but especially in a club like Žalgiris. I think the captain holds a big name. Where do you keep the culture in check and in line when you see somebody is trying to escape the culture in that sense?
I mean, with the locker room, it's easy because Jankūnas was there all the time. And for me as a GM, I always thought that, you know, we have to have the, like in our body, we have the backbone. So you have to have the backbone of the guys who are there and who continue to follow the tradition. So for me, all these years, Jankūnas was the main guy. And then if you have Milaknis, if you have Kalnietis, then you have Ulanovas, you have the core. And you know that this core will stick together no matter what. So in the locker room, it was quite easy because you need to keep those guys who know and who are verbal, you know, and they will push the newcomers and teach the newcomers, you know, what it's like to be in the club. In the office, you know, I'm the captain. I'm the boss. And I have to show myself what the values are. I have to implement them. And again, we joke sometimes. It's not like you come, you know, with a baseball stick and say, okay, you follow this. So we work together. I'm a fan of having the directors come up, you know, and work on this together. We approve all this together. We discuss, and each year we present this. So each year we have presentations for the newcomers to the team, saying, you know, these are the values that we have. This is the vision. This is the mission. Normally we have the rules, but we let the players and the coaches decide what are the main rules. So if the new coach comes, you know, we don't try to put the same things for the new guy because everybody brings something new. But again, in organization, it starts with a head, and you as a head have to continue explaining it, and then HR comes in, and HR has the same things, like, you know, you have to motivate this, you have to award the guys who follow it, and it's again, everything falls into places if everybody goes and works in the same direction.
So that's a perfect transition. If we go into communication, because the communication is important within your staff, you know, away from the coaching staff, but also amongst the coaching staff, and to complete the triangle between you and the staff. So let's talk about the communication between you and the coaching staff, especially with the head coach. If you talk to the head coach and you have, let's say, a disagreement on a certain player, let's say he believes in the player still and you don't believe in the player, or vice versa, how long do you have the patience? How do you communicate? Where do you step back and let the coach do his thing, or where do you step in and say, okay, this is the line, and we have to continue a different direction?
I think I'm on the list that fires many coaches, especially before Šaras. You know, it was many changes. Again, some because I was the GM, but the boss was different. We had the owner who was also, you know, firing the coaches quite often, no matter how good the results are. But again, you know that our job is really easy. We only have to win games. So if you win games, then everybody's happy and everybody's good. And then I'm on the outside, you know, just checking. Again, this balance for me is always, like you said, the players. So I see through the captain's eyes and how they do in practices, how the games are they getting together, you know, are they talking, is everybody having a sad face or unmotivated face. You have this rule of 20-60-20, so 20 are always positive, 20 are always negative, and the 60 shifts to the guys who are more vocal. So if you see that the 20 of unhappy ones are taking over the 60, you know, it's a big problem for the team, and that's when the losing starts, and it's impossible to get back. But again, talking to the coach about the player, you know, he's the boss. I kind of say, okay, now you're the boss. You choose the player. But again, I learned it the hard way, because if you let them go completely on their own, I had coaches that I had to change players every 3 months. You know, it was in a junior system, not the first team, but you know, oh, I want these players. These are really good. You know, we bring them in 3 months later. You know, those guys are sitting on the bench, and three new ones, you know, are much better. So I always say that if somebody from outside is much better than somebody from inside, the coach has to take part of the blame, because we are an organization who, we don't get the best product. We don't get the super talented guys. We get the hungry guys who want to improve. And this is how we need to look at the whole situation. So why is the guy not improving? Either he's in the wrong system, either he's lazy, or the coach doesn't know how to use him, or there's some miscommunication and not all the guys fit. So I am there to always listen to both sides. Then comes the agent, you know, and then there's a family, there's a whole tribe who's saying, you know, you're good, the coach is an idiot. And you know, on the coach's side, you know, you're good, but the player is an idiot. So I have to be in the middle to say that, guys, the goal is the same. For the coach, he wants to win games. For the player, it's the same thing. He wants to win games. So how do we help each other? I'm a good GM if the team wins. So we all want the same thing. How do we balance things out? So I would say the main thing in communication is to be open, to listen, to understand that we are all different. We all have different approaches. We all have different issues. We all look at the world differently. And I don't have to convince you that my view is right, but we have to find the balance to contribute, because at the end, the same goal is to win. And once you start winning, then it's easy, because you're happy, you have testosterone, you know, the fans are supportive, and then it's easy. Then you only have to think what will happen, you know, if we start losing.
Yeah, but you still always have to think steps ahead. You can't just be, you know, observing and chilling. You still have to think what if.
No, but then the main thing, even if we're winning, why are we winning? Are the players getting better? Is the coach getting better? Because, you know, winning is sometimes, it's always temporal. And everybody's adjusting, especially in EuroLeague. Everybody knows in the middle of a season what qualities of the players are used mostly, what qualities of the coach and how to play against him. So you have to constantly evolve, and you have to constantly get better, both individually and as a team. And, you know, you need time, but you need wins and time. And time doesn't always help, because if you stop developing, then, you know, at the second part of a season, you start going down the hill.
Yes, yes. Where is this 20-60-20 come from? I never heard of it before.
I don't know. I had read books, talk to the guys. I don't know. I will not give you a quote.
Okay, I was thinking maybe there was a certain book or a certain author that you had that from. But it's an interesting dynamic, because there's so much truth to it. You always have different parties. It's very rarely that everybody's on the same page from the beginning. In the beginning, in the preseason, there's this honeymoon period that everybody's on, and then at some point it shifts to one way or the other. And 20-60-20 is about that. That sounds about right. So let's talk a little bit about the situation that you see, that it has to be a cut with the head coach. What's the conversation like? I can imagine that this is the most difficult part of the job, when you have to cut ties, cut loose, and protect the club, protect the vision to move on. And it's hard to step into coach's shoes. It's also hard to step into your shoes. So I'm wondering, what's the line? What's the conversation like, the first conversation? But it's leading up to, because there's a feeling on both sides that it's kind of coming, you know, especially in this profession. So when do you feel that you have to meet with them and say, all right, this is up until here and not further?
I always, again, it's about being open. And firing happens when you start losing. And when you start losing, again, I talk to the players and I talk to the coaching staff and try to see the balance, if they both trust each other or not. Players will never tell me, you know, fire the coach. I have never had it in my 16 years. They would, you know, sometimes they would be like, yeah, you know, it could be a little bit better, but, you know, we need to do it ourselves. Like, it's I always wanted Jan Kunas to come and say, you know, fire this coach, he's bad. It never happens. They never said it. But you can see if they trust the process again. Or if they trust the vision of the coach. On the coach's side, it's the same thing. He needs to trust. It's his soldiers. So he needs to trust the players. If there's no trust in both sides, I always give, you know, I never come and say, okay, you're fired. So we sit down and we start discussion. And if I see that the coach is saying, okay, I can improve this, I can improve that, then I will help him with the player saying, you know, what do you want me to tell this or that player? I will call the agent and say, you know, please do the same thing. Because again, it's if we win and the players play good, everybody's happy. The value goes up, the coach is happy, the player's value goes up, and so on. But if I have this conversation and I see that, you know, the coach doesn't take anything on him, mm-hmm. and he starts blaming the players, for me, it's a red flag. So then I'll go to the assistants and say, okay, guys, you know, you work with him every day. We need to improve this. We need to improve that. We need to help him open his eyes. The other thing that I always control and I always say to the coach is like, I want you to not lose your head. Because, and what I mean is that once you start losing, you don't sleep at night, you know, you take pills to fall asleep. You cannot go outside. The media is attacking you because, you know, you're playing in EuroLeague, so all eyes are on you. Everywhere you go, you know, to the store, to the haircut, whatever, everybody's talking about the same thing. And when you're losing, everybody's carrying you on their hands and you're a demigod. But if you're losing, everybody's like, yeah, you know, but, and you feel that negative energy and it takes your head away. And if you cannot see the things clearly, then it's a problem. You start to, you know, you only see the negative and you don't look at the situation like, what can I control and what can I change? So if the coach loses his head, and again, in our job, there's many ways, not too many options, but there's many ways, you know, to clear the head, you know, go outside, take a day off, go to the seaside, go to the sauna like we do with Coach Krapikas. And you know, you sit there, you talk, you discuss without any pressure, without anything, and you calm yourself down and you're back in business. But with some coaches, it was never an option. And it just, I know, and you can predict that, you know, if you're in your head is in a bad situation, you exaggerate things, you don't trust the players. So I don't see logical option to get out. So I try once and I try twice. And if I see that the coach is not moving forward, then, you know, I say to myself, I did everything I could, but I need to protect the club.
Yeah, there is a club that, and I don't want to mention the club on air. I don't know if it's something that they want or not, but that they give the head coach some time off during the season and let the assistant coaches run, because just for that reason, just for the emotions to calm down, to have the balance, to see it with a different vision, just to have a little bit of a change of dynamics within the team. It's healthy for the players, for the team to hear different voices, have a little bit different dynamic, and then the head coach comes back to coach again in EuroLeague or whatever. So it's I think it's healthy. It's a healthy way of balancing and seeing also the mental health of the head coach, because there's this unsurmountable pressure on that position. And if you don't have empathy for that, it's going to be, like you said, a trickle-down effect on everybody. What qualities do you usually look for a head coach before you hire them? Is that something you look for, the mental strength of a head coach? Is there development in the first place? What are the when you scout the head coach that you are planning to hire or you like, what are the key aspects that you look for?
For me, any position you hire, you want a guy who wants to improve. If I come up to the guy and I see that he knows everything, or he gives me these, you know, basic cliche things like, we will go all in, you know, I trust the players. These are the typical phrases, you know, I'm a players coach. I have a good connection with all the players. And we know this world. You can call any player and ask him what's the situation, not directly, but through somebody else. So I want him to be hungry to improve, because this is the kind of team that that we're in. And then obviously I want him to know that we have this Lithuanian core that you have to focus on, and you cannot expect, you know, to all the Lithuanians to sit on the bench, bring all the foreigners, because this is not Žalgiris. You know, the fans will not support it. It will be difficult for us as a club to grow the players and get the other players. Then we don't need the junior system, which is also important. So you have to understand where you're coming into and to sell it to me, basically. You know, I know, again, from scouting, who is more of offensive coach, who is more defensive coach, who gives the guys more the freedom, you know, to develop, who's really strict, again, like Šaras. I think Željko is the same way. Like, they tell the player exactly where and how and when. And you also have to be, you know, you have to have the same players who would be good for that system and could take the pressure. But, again, I would say two things. You have to adopt to our values, to the system that we have, and then you want to be hungry and to prove something.
Okay, and you also said a little bit before we talked about the coaching, the conversations you have with players due to the coach giving you some information, because that's also the you know, of how you can work on the other way, just to keep the tribe, your tribe, in place. You know, that's the one thing where you work as a team around the players. What's the job that you feel like that your position has to do, and a person in your position has to do, that not many people would think of? You know, when they think of a GM, they think about the scouting players and then hiring players, talking to the agents, and then that holding the organization, holding the team itself in place. There's a lot more nuances to that than people know. What would you say is the most undervalued job that you have?
Tough to say. I mean, you have to be somebody who lets everything go. I mean, I liked Phil Jackson when I read his book, when he's explaining that he tried to let the players decide themselves. He's trying to put everybody in the right situation, but they have to decide themselves, not him. So I view my job the same way. You kind of see if somebody's, it's like guiding a pack of wolves, and somebody's going, and you have to, you know, you don't come with a stick and say, come back. You kind of have to have the path for them to all to stick together. And this is the kind of job that I think nobody understands. It seems like everybody tells you, like, go and tell this guy to do this and this, you know, and it's so simple, like, hey, coach, you need to do this. Or, hey, Iggy, you have to do this. But there's so much more to that. And, you know, just saying this, and again, this is what I don't like about the coaches a lot, because they are taught that, you know, I told these guys to do this and they're not doing this. And for me, it's like, why? Did you ask them why? Did you talk to them? Did you try to understand, you know? Do you think it's intentional? Do you think he's just not capable of doing this? And you know, for me, it's always to ask this why, and see how to get the pack to stay together.
But those are the conversations that not many people think of, you know, that you have to build the relationship, whether it's, you know, with the player, with the assistant coaches. You have to find a way to get through to that person. And that path is different to this person than to that person, you know. And it's you have to develop a feeling over time. That's one thing that you try to watch every practice.
Not anymore, no.
No, because that feels like that's something you see the dynamics, you know, develop, and you see who's good with whom, the reactions to the assistant coaches, to the head coach, and then you kind of get a better feel. But I don't know why did it change? Why is not anymore?
Too much work at the office. Okay. So you know, I mean. Now Jankūnas is doing that. So before we had other guys, and you know, you get an update, you know, if there was a fight, if who's not happy with the role, how the coach is doing. So now I get the other guys, you know, to give the feedback. But then again, I come to the game, even if it's LKL or EuroLeague, you sit at the end of the bench and you can feel it.
Yeah. What's the sports psychology role in this all dynamic? What do you see the sports psychologists come in?
It's key. Again, you had this podcast about Australia and the guy who's responsible for the culture. So we had this position directly involved, indirectly involved, but we have Gintautas, who's with us. He's with me for more than 10 years. You know, we started by him working individually. Then he helps me out on these presentations, on team meetings. So I've been with him for 10 years, and now he's traveling with the team. He's involved completely. And again, this is key. I learned so many things from him. Again, why they do this, you know, we read the books of how the brain responds, you know, how long does it take to teach something for the player to learn a new drill, a new shooting technique, you know, everything. So this is key. For me, it's strange that, again, we as a country are not ready for it, because we still have this stamp that, you know, if you go to psychologist or leadership coach or a mentor, it's a sign of weakness. But we had the guy for more than 10 years, and we are constantly learning, improving, and we had foreigners come in to give a presentation. So again, it's something that I am deeply interested in, reading books, learning new things, and I think it's key.
I think that this is a problem of Eastern Europe and in basketball in general. I think it's still behind. There's a lot of cliches that go with it that keep the sport behind. Also obviously financials, because in soccer, European football, they have a lot of finances in put into sports psychology, and I think it's a key aspect. But it's also, like you say, the it has a stigma attached to it, especially in Eastern Europe, where they see it as a weakness rather than a strength. And all the other Western cultures, NBA also, it's a strength.
I disagree about the finance. I mean, you have 10 plus million budgets, and you know, for you to spend 0.5 or 0.05% on this, it's crazy. I mean, the same with charters and traveling. Like, you know, you have to spend the money to get the players rested. You cannot say, okay, you know, it doesn't matter. So
yeah,
working here, it's key. Money is not an issue. It's the mentality and understanding is the problem.
Very good. Very good. Last question on this part is what are the most undervalued, the competition off the court between the executives, the GMs, the sports directors, you know, that you have. You're recruiting a player that the other team is also recruiting. You don't know who's recruiting them. There's a lot of rumors out there. What's the competition system for the executives behind the scenes that nobody would really think about? That, you know, how to get one player convinced that he should come to you and not the other team, taking the money into account, taking the agents into account. What's the battle behind the scenes?
I mean, for me, it's easy, because I always say what we have and what we don't have. So we cannot compete as a city, you know, of Kaunas and Lithuania, and no matter how much I love the place and I'm local and for me it's the best place ever. But if you want to bring a foreigner, you know, you cannot compete with Barcelona's weather, Milan's weather, Madrid's and Athens and Tel Aviv's and so on and so forth. So you know what you cannot give, but you know, you have to know the strengths. And you don't, I mean, I'm always okay saying the weaknesses. Like we one of the smallest budgets, so you will not get as much money as you can get offered. But if you come here, you know, that's the best place for you to develop. Because again, with all due respect to LKL, it's weaker and the competition is not as strong as the ACB or Turkish league or I don't know, Italian league. The traveling is much easier. That's why it's also a big bonus for you, you know, to relax after the good game, to get recovery and so on and so forth. And then of course we have the fans. So we focus on the strengths, and I always sell the strengths. And if you want to develop, if your goal is to develop, you belong here. If your goal is to make money, you belong here and then go make the money. So some clubs, they start to change this. And for me, it's they just mix things up. So if you're a big budget club, don't worry about developing the players. Somebody else has to develop the player, and you have to have him ready. But some guys start, we're going to develop this guy. No, you need winning results. And if you bring the guy and, your team is not performing well, this guy will be sitting on the bench. So, again, you have to know what you have. And there's no competition. For me, I mean, I get along well with all the GMs. And I see us as a part of the group who are in the same business. There's a huge influence by the agents as well. So we compare to the NBA, as far as I know, and what I see when I go to Vegas, we still lack this openness, and we lack the rules, to know how much the other club is offering, to have the salary cap and all that stuff. So I'm again transitioning to another subject, how we need to improve as a league to keep moving forward.
So this is perfect transition. Let's keep talking about the EuroLeague, because that's where I was heading. Where do you see the EuroLeague heading the next years?
I think it's the best basketball in the world. With all due respect, I mean NBA is a completely different product in terms of marketing, revenues, TV rights, and everything. It's a million miles away from any other basketball league, but what we have is this love for the game is different. The passion of the fans. If you see, Belgrade, Greece, Tel Aviv, Kaunas, these main crazy crowds. Again, I want to get rid of this violence. It does not belong in basketball, and we need to stop that. But the passion in Europe is much stronger, and the connection to the clubs and to the game itself, and understanding of the game. It's much bigger. So that's what I think we have to focus on and sell this, and not try to compete with trying to do something what the other guys are doing. So I try to copy the same mentality of the club. Like, you have to know your main strengths, because it's impossible to reproduce this in the States, to have this devotion, again, this word devotion of the fans. I don't think it's possible in the NBA, with all due respect to what they're doing. So this is where what we have to focus on. We have to have to start making money or not losing money, at least. And these are the key points that we have to focus on.
So this is one thing that you mentioned that I had to type down, is TV rights. So that's definitely the biggest, probably, source of, or one of the biggest sources of revenue that could be potentially be had. How do you see potentially unifying all the TV rights? Because they're different. Each country has their own different ways of streaming the games, or showing on TV, not showing on TV. Is there a way of consolidating the TV rights to a one group?
Again, I hope I'm not naive. When the lessons learned, don't be naive, but I'm still naive.
I'd like to stay naive too. I mean, I believe.
I mean, and it's not about being naive. I it's just the word that I use. But I think we are in the business of basketball, and like in every business, you have to compete, but you also have to understand who's the user of the product. So for me, the core thing where you have to stand on is the fans, because we do it for the fans. Yes, we do want to win. Yes, we want trophies. Yes, we want recognition as coaches, as GMs, as players. This is sport. But the end user is the people who come to the games, the people who buy the jerseys, the people who watch the games on TV. And there's FIBA, there's NBA, there's other leagues, there's national leagues. So we're selling the same product. And if we fight and try to keep as much as possible to ourselves, the end user is losing, because we are not sharing. So I don't think we can come together and say, okay, let's do it all together. But because at the end we will be stuck trying to understand who gets what part of the share and so on. But I'm naive thinking that we can sit down together and say, okay, this is the market that's out there. How can we maximize the market altogether? And that's, again, that's the key. And if we take the egos out, if we take the traditions out, if we try to look from the other angle, I think this is the only way to move forward.
Can you put a market value, a value on each market, and then take the percentages out to put it in one pot to consolidate the TV rights into one big, huge pot from each country?
Benas, it's again, my mentality is that money is not the key thing. And if we start fighting about how much money we all make, it's taking us nowhere, because there's not a right formula that you can put in. There's so much intangible that you cannot count. My mentality would be that, okay, this is the market that we have. How do we share all the additional market that we take in? This is the key. But again, we have to focus on the product that we present. The national teams have to be 100% best national teams with NBA players and EuroLeague players. We cannot have, in my opinion, in my humble opinion, to be a national team player. And we basketball people know that it's not the first 12, the second 12, it's like the third 12. With all respect to the guys, but this is the system. And it goes the other way around. Like the leagues, EuroLeague is the strongest competition in Europe. So it has to have the best players possible to play, you know. And we should not fight over this, because the fans need to see the best product. And if they see the best national team product, if they see the best EuroLeague product, the NBA product, national leagues product, then we move forward, because we have to compete with other sports, with other leisure activities. We have to compete with cinema. So we have to be united, trying to take the people from there to come watch the games. And again, it has to be the best product.
So let's fix the calendar here on my podcast once and for all. this is the task of the century, I think, for all the executives involved, to have this aligned with each other, right? Because everybody wants their product to shine, no matter what competition it is. Everybody wants there to be the best players, whether it's EuroLeague has to have the best players available, then the national team has to have the best players available, and so on. So do you think that the calendar can be aligned? Is there a way to align it to have an ideal number of teams and to crunch the calendar so that it's possible to have everybody compete where they should compete and where they're invited to compete?
If I say yes, do you think I'm naive or no? I think yes, everything is possible. I mean, you sit down and you negotiate. And again, I get back to the same thing that I'm repeating and repeating. What's the goal of this? If the goal is to have the fans see the best product, basketball, I'm not talking who's playing, but basketball, then it's possible. Because if we all come with the same vision, we are not stupid in any organization to not understand how it's done. It's just that, you know, historically we have done one thing. Then the sponsors are pushing the leagues to do this. The TV is pushing the leagues to do that. Then, you know, the federations are pushing to do this because they have their sponsors. And, you know, there's so many people who have the pressure or put the pressure that's why it's difficult to have a solution. But theoretically, I think it's doable. Maybe I'm naive, okay, but in theory, of course, you can sit down and fix it.
What's the ideal number for the EuroLeague? Not ideal number of teams?
No, it's not about the teams. I think we can have more. It's difficult to say how many teams, because when you ask this, it's always the question about the national leagues, you know. Yep. Some leagues have 18, some have 12, but play three rounds and so on and so forth. So when you ask one part, if I say the exact number, then I insult the other part. So that's where, you know, I have to be diplomatic and say that, again, we have to look at the bigger picture. And if we focus, okay, if everybody says EuroLeague is the best competition in Europe and we focus on that, then we understand that we need to sacrifice something.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a ever evolving process that needs to be handled as you go, and then negotiate just to keep everybody, also not to lose value in the other leagues. Tell me a little bit about the idea of the play-in tournament.
Again, it's I think it's a good thing. I'm not afraid to say that I was skeptical when the MBA started it, but we see that it's additional value. And with these small margins of wins, I think it brings some, again, extra good games for the people to come and watch, and an extra chance for the guys, you know, to get into the playoffs and compete for the trophy. So if you had a bad start of a season and you have a good run at the end, you know, it's you get a chance to get into the playoffs.
I think that this is probably the first big positive now, looking at the tournament itself and at the impact it can have, that more teams are competing to get into the playoffs, you know, the play-in tournament, but it's also, you can consider those playoffs, mini playoffs. And it's something that also the fans love, because it drives the fans more to watch. There's something hanging even more on the games than it is. You know, as you said, EuroLeague is the most competitive and one of the most passionate leagues that you see, that you watch, and that gives the other teams a chance to compete in that tournament to seek some results that they can you know, that the club can also be happy about going forward.
And plus it's an extra revenue if you play home games, so you know, extra TV revenue, extra ticket sales revenue, and you know, it's the highest competition at the end of the season, so the stakes are high and everybody's locked in. So to have more games of that, I think it's only a win-win, again, to the clubs themselves, to the fans, and to the players to have an extra chance to prove themselves.
Absolutely. What do you think about the relegation system?
What do you mean by that?
Teams that are in the bottom two at the end of a season, is there a realistic way that could be dropping out of the league and to make it more competitive at the bottom as well?
Again, the problem is that we have licensed clubs, who are, yes, owners of the league, and to have the relegation, it's, again, I think if you look at football, European football, soccer, we call it football, it's an interesting system, but you know, there's two signs of in each point. So competition wise, you would think it's a good thing, but in order to have stability and in order for the clubs to be as strong as possible, you cannot have that, because right now the clubs who make it only yearly, you know, to the EuroLeague or EuroCup, for them it's difficult to find sponsors, for them it's difficult to grow the fan base, because it takes time. So it's, you know, I don't think there's one truth how it has to be done. There's both sides, so you have to find the best possible solution. And again, would it bring more competitiveness? In my idea, no, because if you're a competitor, you want to win. If you're going to be relegated, that brings what, extra motivation to win? I don't believe in that. So if I look at the club stability and club development, I think it's not a good idea. In the league's case, again, we cannot have it, because we have clubs who are shareholders and will stay there no matter what. So it's not an equal competition to have this relegation for the teams who don't have the shares and versus the teams who have the shares.
I think that is probably too much of a case-by-case study, not study, but case-by-case scenario, depending on each season, depending on the club. There's too much variation, as we see this year also with Gran Canaria and EuroCup winning, potentially playing EuroLeague, but not playing EuroLeague. So there's probably too many variables from season to season to make this a reality.
And if you make it too complicated, again, the people and the fans will not understand. So you have to make it simple.
That's true. That's very true. I think I squeezed enough out of you today. Are you ready for my ATOs, or are you done for today?
Oh no, let's go.
I feel like I'm squeezing as much as I can in every possible direction. I think we have a good amount of information out here.
I mean, you know, it's my first interview as a EuroLeague CEO, so I know that I have my opinion, but as a club, I know what to say, because I've done that so many times. I've been there for so long, and I have the path where, you know, I was leading the team. Now, as a EuroLeague CEO, I still don't know what the shareholders think. We have to rethink the vision. We have these talks with different organizations. I don't know their mentality, so it's quite tough. You're squeezing, but I'm also feeling that the second second half that we have is not as easy, because it's everything new, and it's a learning experience for me too. So it's not the questions that I'm used to answering, and it's not easy. But yeah, I hope OTOs will be.
I apologize if I put you in a tough spot here or there.
No, it's good. You know, we go holding hands together. Like,
so. Yeah. This is the beginning. This is just the beginning. Just all right. So if you, the first ATO, I'm drawing it up for you. If you had to teach a class tomorrow, what would it be about?
Leadership.
Who or what influenced your thinking the most from the past?
My trip to the States, I went as an exchange student when I was 17. That was, you know, that changed my mentality, me growing up as a person. So I would say that one.
That was the biggest mind shift in your life?
It opened up, you know, a lot more the vision and the, you know, the sphere of how to think, what to think, completely new culture. It just, you know, it left the mark for the whole life.
How old were you?
17.
Okay. Best worthwhile professional investment?
Anything. And like, I have 3 masters. I just went to Harvard Business School, which was my dream. I want to go again and again and again. I mean, whatever you invest in, it doesn't matter. Just keep learning new things.
Best worthwhile personal investment?
A family. My son, my wife. It's, again, the son is teaching me so many new things. I'm hoping I'm teaching him new things. And my wife too. You know, as a family, you're learning and growing, and it's not as easy as with the employees, because you know you can have a fight, you can fire, you know, and family is completely different. So to grow together, it's a challenge, and it's an interesting challenge.
One habit that impacts your daily life?
Practice. I mean, working out, going to the gym. If I don't have a chance to do it, I feel really bad physically, mentally, and so on.
And sauna with Krapikas.
Yeah. This is the second one.
Once a week. Number one challenge for a GM during the season?
Again, to keep the wolf pack together. Not to lose the head, either if you're losing or if you're winning, because both extremes have negative effect.
Number one challenge after the season?
To know what to change. Again, if you lost, you're in depression, and you tend to see things and everything's in black. And if you win, you finish on a positive note, and you think always positive, but you have to not forget the challenges you had, so you don't bring them to the next season, because the next season is completely different story.
And last one, if you want to be successful in this business, whatever position you're in, does work-life balance exist?
I don't think it exists anywhere. It's impossible. We always look for it, but there's no formula how to have it. Wherever you put the energy more, it takes over, and you have to get back. I don't think you can have that balance where you can relax and say, you know, I'm in this sacred place, and I will cherish it now for 5-10 years. It's impossible.
I think so too. All right, Paulus, Acho, thank you very much. And
thank you.
I wish you all the best in your new challenges, new endeavors, and I'm sure we will see each other very soon.
Looking forward to that. Thank you.
Thank you, everybody, for being here. Bye.